Hello and welcome to the Bear Mat Chit Chat. You know the score by now, we are talking all things Land Rover. And today we have two very special guests from either side of the planet. Dave Budge from Jaunt Motors Australia and Andrew Whittam from EV Land Rover, New Jersey, USA. Both do EV conversions of Land Rover series trucks, and this episode discusses all the trials and tribulations of this greener future for the Green Oval. Welcome to Dave Budge from Jaunt Motors in Melbourne, Australia, and to Andrew Whittam from EV Land Rovers in New Jersey, USA. It's really great for us to have a worldwide podcast this evening. Well, I say this evening, it's this evening for myself at 11 p.m. here in the UK, and for Andrew, 6 p.m., quarter past six in New Jersey. And good morning to you, Dave. So if we could just start with a quick introduction to yourselves personally, and also just a little bit about the business that you're building around the concept of electric vehicles based on Land Rovers.
So I started Jaunt Motors with a business partner of mine, Martin, a couple of years ago. And that was really, you know, as a, I've always loved Land Rovers, always owned a Land Rover all my life. But I guess I did that because I loved what they could do and where they could take me, and went camping. And I wasn't really, I wouldn't say I was a car enthusiast. I just loved what I could do with the car and where it could take me, particularly in Australia, where we have huge distances and difficult terrain. So a Land Rover was always a perfect car. And then I'd been working in a totally different industry in sort of design and advertising, communications and technology. And we sort of started Jaunt as a reaction or a, hopefully a solution to the problem that, you know, Australia is one of the worst or the slowest in the world to adopt electric vehicles. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But if you look at the, and it's a bit of a chicken and egg thing, no one's really buying electric vehicles here, but there's not very many electric vehicles for sale. And there's particularly not any real true four-wheel drives. And that is the majority of Australian car sales by far, is modern, you know, sort of Japanese dual cab utes, SUVs, more than in almost any other country. And so that just doesn't correlate with the electric vehicles that are available. So we'd sort of seen that the idea of EV conversions matured to a point where it wasn't so much about making it work. It was about making it work well and packaging that well and creating good design and putting that in, into cars that people, you know, really loved rather than cars that just made complete logical sense. And I think I'd be the first to admit that Land Rovers don't always make logical sense, particularly driving a 60s Series 2A in 2021 doesn't always make the most sense, no matter what the powertrain is, but it is a wonderful car and it hooks you emotionally. And I think that we saw an opportunity to do that. And while we'll never be doing the volumes that's going to change the Australian car landscape, I think we can be perhaps an inspiring part of the electrification of vehicles here and get people both excited about, you know, what EVs can be and the fact that you can, you know, upcycle and recycle these amazing cars and get them on the road for another 30, 40, 50 years.
Amazing stuff. Andrew, is it a similar story for you? Tell us a bit about yourself.
I felt quite inspired by that, Dave. That sounded great, actually. I concur with pretty much everything Dave said, but I come from a very different background, completely opposite, really, in some ways. I come from an engineering background. I started my apprenticeship with aircraft engineering, specializing in avionics, which was electronics and AC and DC power. And I've always been a car enthusiast and an engineer first since the 70s. And in fact, I remember in the 60s, when my father was in the Royal Air Force, we had a Land Rover, and that's what we drove around in when we lived in Cyprus. So even from about 6 or 8 years old, I've been passionate about vehicles and passionate about Land Rovers. And I completely agree and feel inspired by what Dave said, because unlike Australia, the US is actually very much going towards electrification. They love their vehicles. They love spending lots of money on fuel and V8s. And in fact, I've got three V8 Land Rovers here on the floor in my factory at the moment, but it's got to go to electric. They're going to be very popular for a wealthy clientele, without doubt, because they are expensive. Just the components, as Dave would agree with. But the passion of the Land Rover is quite amazing, even within the US. And the interest in electric vehicles is actually phenomenal now in the US. It's actually, we do have a lot of electrical vehicles available for sale. And unfortunately, there are virtually no four-wheel drives SUVs, which are extremely popular here. And I'm not saying that this will change the landscape at all, but I think it will certainly change the landscape or help a little bit for the passion of Land Rovers to continue with the younger generation.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the really interesting things about the projects that you are both running is that I think when we consider sustainability in vehicles, it's often, you know, the common vision of sustainability is internal combustion engines versus, you know, electrical nowadays. But in a roundabout way, the series vehicles are quite sustainable in themselves because there are hundreds still on the roads from 50 years ago. And just goes to show that this kind of almost metal can that's been running around the planet for 50 years, you've almost combined the sustainability in what Land Rover did in terms of a really rugged vehicle that you can just bash the panels out and it's not necessarily good as new, but, you know, has its authenticity. And obviously the engines and the drivetrain, you switched up for a electric drivetrain. I think that's a nice synergy that I was certainly getting. You know, Dave, obviously I've been following Jaunt Motors and the build with Juniper for probably about a year now. And that's one thing that I considered is that series vehicles in a roundabout way, although we, you know, they are dreadful for the planet in terms of obviously the internal combustion engines and the particulates and whatnot that the diesel engines churn out, the sustainability in terms of the materials used and the longevity of the vehicle is quite considerable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I think it's Australia is a bit of, you know, again, another unique sort of automotive landscape in that we don't have annual emissions tests or annual roadworthies. If you've registered your car in 1975 and you've kept it registered, no one has checked if it's safe to drive, if it's polluting, whatever, it can still be on the road quite legally. So it means we have this huge, I guess, availability of old vehicles that people have kept running. It doesn't mean they're in great condition, but it means they're at least around and they haven't been scrapped like some other markets. And still, though, you know, I think the stats are in Australia, and, you know, where are they, 25 million people, but it's still 100,000 tons of waste go to landfill every year from vehicles reaching end of life. So there's all the steel and aluminium that usually gets recycled. There's still 100,000 tons of plastic and all this other stuff. And so like you mentioned, you know, you've got these Land Rovers that, you know, the story really here is, and, you know, very broadly speaking, that Australia was buying something ridiculous, like half the Land Rovers being made in the 60s and 70s. So every farm, every government department, they were everywhere. And then Toyota came out with a better dealer network, a more reliable, more powerful engine with the Land Cruiser in the 70s. And kind of everyone just put the Land Rovers in their shed and forgot about them. And because they're aluminium, they didn't really rust out and they didn't really go anywhere. So there's a lot of them out there. And then bringing that forward to now, you've got this vehicle that both can look fine and, in fact, perhaps better with a few dents and waves in the panels. But even if you have to replace them, they're completely available because you can interchange parts from a part of a wing from a 2015 Defender onto a series vehicle, which is incredible. And the parts are cheap and available. And when we're countering that to the fact that, you know, we're buying, and I think you are too, Andrew, buying Tesla batteries, which are all from salvaged Teslas, which are usually write-offs, but they're write-offs because of body damage for the most part, because we're taking, you know, taking all the good bits from the drivetrain out. So they're written off because of body damage, but a Land Rover does not get written off by body damage because the cost is so cheap and it's so easy to repair. And we've even found that as we've gone to insure the vehicles that we're putting on the road now, that we say, well, yeah, they're a very expensive vehicle, but we're actually able to break that down with the insurance company and say, well, actually all the expensive bits are inside this boxy ladder frame. The likelihood of them getting damaged is very, very low. The likelihood of the panels getting damaged might be quite high, but unlike a new car where you damage the front plastic bumper and it's $1,000 part, it's like, oh well, you know, you've hit the wing and well, we'll just swap out that little bit of the panel and that's $100 and you know, and some paint and away we go. So it's very much been a vehicle that has been able to be kept on the road for this long and continue to be with minimal waste and a very, I guess it's from another era when you still repaired your toaster. I feel like Land Rovers in many ways are kind of continue that. Oh, it's just that bit and unscrew that, put that back on, you know, no special tools required and away you go.
Well, having totally failed to fix a toaster the other day, very frustrating, very annoying for me. I probably spent $200 of man hours trying to fix a $30 toaster. But yeah, absolutely. I get really excited. I'm sat here in my factory now looking at this Series 2A and, you know, the things in mainly in pieces, but the parts are all just so accessible. And I just love the fact that the heritage of this Land Rover and its years and the few little dings and things that it's got in it, they just speak to me. And that might sound a bit romantic, but I think it speaks to my customers as well and people who see them in the street. They just really love the fact that it's a simple, beautiful design. And it's got a few wrinkles and creases like all of us, but yet it's got a heart of ultra modern technology, a reliable, ultimately simple, apart from the battery management system and the Tesla batteries, which Dave would know about, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a beautiful thing. And I think more people nowadays are really looking to go back to that sort of technology, and especially the younger generations.
We sort of internally talk about that as that we're trying to create vehicles that belong. And by that, we mean we're building one here that's going to go back up to a farm. And it's from that farm, the dents and panel damage that we've left in are from its history on that farm. You know, it's had a fresh paint job, but it doesn't mean that every, you know, panel has been, you know, smoothed out to smoother than it would have left the factory. It's left how it was. And so that sense of belonging in terms of a history and a connection to that place, not as a make and a model of car, which I think sort of separates the Land Rover in that the cars themselves have individual personality and they're not special just because, oh, it was this engine and this era of this thing and it's this point. Yes, they're an automotive classic, but each car sort of has had a very interesting life in almost every scenario. And so if we can bring that back even to the place where it spent its formative years and do that in a way that then perhaps is recharging off solar generated at that location or another renewable resource and isn't, you know, spitting out carbon and other pollutants back into that environment, well, that is truly a vehicle that really belongs to that place as much as the old farmhouse or whatever it might be.
Exactly. It's really fantastic to hear you both speaking so passionately about these vehicles. I am conscious, however, that obviously people that exist in the Land Rover community, a lot of them will be petrol heads. A lot of them will, you know, have this affinity for the raw internal combustion engine. I think that those people particularly exist in Land Rover communities. Obviously, you know, the US and Australia are probably two of the countries where unless you're driving a V8 or more, you're almost laughed at. So I'm just interested, what's the kind of reception that you have experienced in your own communities? Have you had many conversations locally with Land Rover enthusiasts and what are their thoughts on these electric vehicle conversions? Could you start us off, Andrew, please?
Yeah. And again, I just sort of reiterate the younger generations, you know, you're talking about the 25 to 30, 40 year old entrepreneur types or people who are used to modern technology. And some of them have been to visit me, you know, I had some guys turn up actually the other day in G-Wagons and very high end SUVs, but they were just really turned on by the fact that, you know, they are electric, even though they were petrol heads. Now, I think the generation myself, I'm 61, is probably less likely to be enthused about it, but that's their problem. I don't sort of apologize for that, and I'm sure Dave wouldn't either. To encourage new people to be involved in Land Rovers and to be enthused about them, I think we just have to move with the times.
Yeah.
And I would like to stress, though, I'm only converting ones that are diesels or really ratty engines, petrol ones. I've just picked up a Stage 1 V8, which is sort of the ultimate petrol head series. And I did think about converting it, but that would be criminal, I think, personally, because it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
So there's room for all of us in the community, but I think there will be resistance from the older generation, myself type age group, but so be it. I can't apologize for that.
And Dave, what's the reaction been like in Australia?
Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised. I think that the Land Rover community has always been about modding cars. And, you know, the first thing you do when you buy a new Land Rover is probably drill a hole and add some accessory to it. And so that, you know, and in Australia in particular, even in the 60s, 70s, people were swapping out the Land Rover engine and putting what was a more common and just very slightly more powerful Holden motor in it. So that history of sort of engine mods and swaps has always been part of it. I've seen, though, that with series vehicles in particular, those engines, and I think, you know, they're an amazing fit for the vehicles, and I quite love driving an old series, whether it's petrol or diesel, for different reasons, they feel quite different. But people weren't buying them for the engine. They weren't buying them because it was this beautiful, you know, V8 masterwork. It was an economical practical motor. And so swapping that out for something that's more powerful and more reliable and simpler and electric has not been met with much resistance and really a lot of enthusiasm. And the only thing that people that perhaps comes up is people, you know, saying, oh, look, it's sacrilege. These are an automotive classic and whatever. And I'm not the one having to defend anything like this. Immediately someone will follow up with, yeah, but there's like 2 million of them and there's plenty in museums. What do we want to do? Like have, you know, everyone's aware that if you've got the original motor and particularly in a series, you're probably not driving it that much because it might not always start or it might have these other issues. And unless you want to tinker with it, which is fun in itself, what should we be doing with these cars? We should be driving them. And so people are enthused that here's a way to make series vehicles more drivable, more usable. I agree with Andrew that as you come into these, you know, stage one V8s are pretty rare in Australia and, I'd be really hesitant to convert one of those. I think that, you know, they're a really interesting thing where I'm literally sitting right now in a 2013 Defender here, actually on a hoist because I was trying to find a soundproof area in the workshop to be in. So I'm sitting in the back of a 2013 Defender TDI, you know, 2.4 Puma, and we'll be converting this. And no one seems to, I mean, it's a common engine that's in so many cars here. So no one seems particularly upset. I think everyone, Tesla's made electric cars. It's been clear that there's performance in electric. And so then the only qualms is around range. And so when we talk about four-wheel driving, Australians get obsessed about distance, particularly where you're from. I'm in Victoria, and Victoria is kind of the size of the UK, or sort of, you know, England, Scotland. So the distances aren't amazing. But when you get over to, say, Western Australia, where you leave Perth and you've got to drive for 5 hours before you get to anything worth getting to, and then maybe 2 days to get where you're going, distance becomes the thing. And so that's the backlash we've had is around, well, not backlash, but just the, I won't be going there until I can get 1,000 kilometers kind of thing.
Sure. But at the same time, I'm sure this stat must have changed a little bit. But I remember when I started visiting Australia, I think about 90% of your population live within 10 miles of the coast or something along those lines. Yeah. So when you look at it like that, okay, yes, as you say, I remember when I was living in Sydney and the distance up to Newcastle is like maybe 4 hours. But, you know, that's, you know, you could cross the UK in that time pretty much. So I'm sure for the everyday runabout, and obviously these cars have the potential to be quite stylish and you know, certainly turn heads. So if that's what you're intending it for, and you need to do 10 miles to the coast on your trip,
totally,
it's perfect, isn't it?
The average Australian, you know, like anywhere, I think the average Australian does 38 kilometers a day or something like that if they're driving a car. So no one is really doing these giant trips. And I guess that whether we need it or whether we've been sort of brainwashed into it by years of automotive marketing that we need a car that can take us across the country and through the outback, that's the kind of cars that people are buying cars for, the once a year, once every 5 years massive trip that they do. And the rest of the time, it's a kind of a car that's perhaps inappropriate for the suburbs and the short commute they do. But I think the same time, we're building series Land Rovers. If you can drive for 300 kilometres, 200-300 kilometers on a charge in a series Land Rover, how much more driving do you want to do in a series Land Rover in one day? It's not the most comfortable car ever. You're driving for fun and the enjoyment of driving and the journey. So, you know, have a little break, recharge.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I think my clientele here will be people who will, you know, be driving it to the beach, you know, driving it to the country club. I know that sounds really poncy, Dave, but it's probably reality. I don't think any of these series Land Rovers are going to be out in the outback. And I used to live in Alice Springs. I lived for years. I was the flying doctor out in Alice for years and then up in Papua New Guinea. So I know Australia well. And I don't think anybody is going to be driving these things anywhere far for two good reasons. The comfort, and why would you when you don't have AC, etc. And just the range. And I'm looking, I don't know about you, Dave, but I'm looking at a range, really a realistic range of about 130, 140 miles. So people should feel relaxed about doing 50 so they can get back 50 and leave. But it's the range is the biggest issue, I think.
Yeah.
It's definitely the range. We don't have to go crazy. I did 2,500 miles last weekend to pick up this stage one. I drove all the way down to Florida, and there's no way anybody's going to do that in a Land Rover. It's just not going to happen.
There are limitations anyway.
Saying that, we did pick up a Land Rover up in up in Queensland and drove about 4,500 kilometres back in that over a few days. And I recommend it once in a lifetime, but I don't recommend it as a routine thing.
Yeah, I went to pick up this stage one V8 in Naples, Florida. I say it was 2,500 miles round trip. And I dropped a friend's Series 2A off on the way down. But I've got a 300 TDI D90, which can pull 8,000 pounds. And a friend of mine said, are you really going to do that in your Defender? And I said, actually, no. Can I borrow your big fat ass pickup? I have to say, it was far more comfortable. But just to just to go back a bit on that, guys, I just think the interest level on these things is really coming from women. Phenomenally, and I know that sounds sexist, having four sisters and three daughters, but the response from women has been phenomenal because they don't want to deal with diesel engines, they don't want to deal with manual gearboxes, even though I'm leaving the gearbox in. I think you are as well, aren't you, Dave?
Yeah, we are. Yeah,
but you can just leave it in third. And I think the increase in viability for people of interest is actually going to be significantly increased because of its much more usability, actually.
Yeah, and we've coming from marketing background and things, you know, really understanding how much, you know, major purchases in any family are a joint decision, and so you've got to speak to both parties, and so there's an element of, you know, we really wanted to make these vehicles. I think that conversion to electric makes them very approachable and very accessible, so you are not scared of. Who uses a choke anymore? How does anyone know what to do with that? How do you start these old cars? Who wants to deal with like a diesel? Oh, you turn the key off, the car won't stop. You've got to pull this fuel cutter off. Like, it just seems weird. That is not, people don't want to approach that, and it's intimidating to use. And I don't think we should be gatekeeping the driving experience of these things because you don't understand how to operate this crazy mechanical explosion box, you know. So I think it's making them a simple, beautiful, easy to operate car benefits everybody.
Absolutely, absolutely. So another similarity between the US and Australia, certainly from my experiences, is the amazing opportunities that you both have in your respective homes for the amazing huge national parks and obviously the outdoor lifestyles that extends to you. Dave, obviously you've spoken just then about the overlanding and how Land Rovers and outdoor adventures are kind of two sides of the same coin. I also remember from watching one of your videos, the story about the radiator grills on the Series 2As and how they were used as makeshift barbecues for adventures out in the bush. So have you had much experience of the Land Rover communities around you with clubs and events? Is there much around you, Dave?
Yeah, there is, and they've been super enthusiastic about you know what we're doing. There's a huge number of, you know, Land Rover clubs, Range Rover clubs, all these different, you know, four wheel drive clubs around here, and we've had a few events with them in the workshop with a couple of clubs during our sort of COVID lockdown. We were doing Zoom presentations through to the club meetings in different parts of the country, which was really fun. And I've gone out and done a number of other presentations to people, and been really interesting because often Land Rover clubs or a lot of clubs, it's I have a gray beard too, so I'm going to say it's just guys with gray beards. That includes me. Those kinds of enthusiast clubs are a certain demographic, and you know, unfortunately, I think you get like it's 90% guys. But what we've seen is that we've had women coming along to those, usually wives of guys who are coming along to the events, and they're like, oh no, I don't really want to drive. I don't like driving the old cars. I haven't driven a manual. One woman drove it, and she was like, I haven't driven a manual in 30 years. And to your point, Andrew, I was like, no, it's fine. We'll just put it in third. You can start it in third. You don't have to press the clutch or anything. It's fine. And she drove it and had a great time and didn't want to get out and did change gears just to, because she wanted to go faster. But it's been a really great thing to see people sort of claw over it. And I think when they see the level of care and detail that we put into the rest of the build, where it's very much coming from a place of, we love old Land Rovers. We just want to get out and drive them. While we might be changing a lot of elements, it's still very, very much an old Land Rover.
Perfect. So what's your experience of the Land Rover communities around you, Andrew?
It's very enthusiastic in the United States. You know, anything British, especially with the recent events, is very enthusiastic. There are quite a lot of clubs in this area, the Northeast of the United States. and I believe, you know, all over the United States, Americans tend to be purists, probably more than Australians, because they weren't brought up with Land Rovers and the utility of them. So they're slightly, probably a bit more grey-beardy rather than your lot, Dave, because Land Rovers, like, you know, when I lived in Australia, they're just to a penny, and certainly in Britain, very much to a penny. But in the United States, they're certainly, you know, they're definitely rivet counter types and, the, you know, purist perfectionists. But I think once we get the prototype finished and it's taken out and about, I'll be taking it to various clubs, various meetings. I think there'll be a great amount of interest. And again, I reiterate, from those people who probably wouldn't have been interested before, but it's much more accessible to them rather than seeing their gnarly old husbands, you know, thrashing around, changing gears, spinning the wheels up and down, you know, dirt tracks. I think it will be a much more accessible experience. When I've ever had any old Land Rovers in my local town, which is a very cute town, it's the children and the people you just wouldn't expect, you know, women in society, who are the ones who are definitely the most enthusiastic about them. It's incredible. I think they're just so unthreatening and cool classics that it just appeals to so many people.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really interesting and important. I've met several women at Land Rover events, and you're right, often they are coming along with their husbands and families, but at the same time we do also have good connections with lots of ladies that are massive Land Rover enthusiasts around the world. You know, we have sponsored the Rebel Rally, for example, in the past, which is a endurance and navigation 4x4 test, I guess. We've also got lots of podcasts lined up with some ladies from the Land Rover community, so that's certainly something to look forward to. But as you say, if these vehicles are making the Land Rover community more accessible to women who may not be interested in traditional Land Rovers and maybe more excited by the concepts that you guys are creating, then that can only be a positive thing. We are, however, at the end of this first episode's timings, so our listeners will need to join in next week for more conversation with Dave Budge from Jaunt Motors and Andrew Whittam from EV Land Rovers. Thank you very much, and I hope you rejoin us next week. Ladies and gents, thank you so much for listening to the Bare Mat Chit Chat today. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and would encourage you to subscribe to our podcast wherever you are listening. We will be back next week with another engaging conversation. But in the meantime, we encourage you to stay connected with us on Facebook and Instagram, as well as our website, www.baremat.com. See you next week for another episode of the Bare Mat Chit Chat.